WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we will end the show today with a treat that is also bittersweet. Robert Krulwich, co-host of Radiolab, is retiring. Now, we and millions of listeners will miss him dearly, but to mark the occasion, we have invited Robert to join us here in the green space this morning to play a few clips from his radio and television career and talk about migrating through the media landscape from around the time of Watergate until today. So please welcome Robert Krulwich to the green space. And I guess this is a good time to remind those of you listening on the radio, if you want to actually see Robert Krulwich's face, you can, because we stream live video when we're in the green space. You can watch the show. Just go to WNYC.org, the homepage of the station, and you will see a live video stream that you can click on, WNYC.org. So I'm going to play a piece of audio right from the get-go.
Okay.
Robert, here to give people who only know you from WNYC a sample of your past creativity. And control room, let's make sure we have the right one queued up first. It's the one from 1974 on Pacifica Radio. The Richard Nixon impeachment process was starting, and Robert was part of a skit intended to explain the impeachment process. This begins with a fictional protest outside the White House where a guy named Bob Zarola has vowed to stand on his head until Nixon is gone. But he's a little confused as he talks to fictional journalist Frank Capo.
Well, Frank, I have pledged to stay on my head until Richard Nixon is impeached and has to leave the White House. And until that happens, I am going to stay here day and night, symbolizing everyone in America who wants to see Nixon impeached and out.
An absolutely amazing protest statement. Bob Zarola just says that he will be on his head, not only through the impeachment of the president, but through the trial as well. That means he will be on his head outside the White House for months and...
Wait a second, what do you mean through the trial as well? All I said was I'll be on my head till he's impeached and out. That's all.
The young man stands on his head for 27 days, and unfortunately, tragically even, he does not know the meaning of the word impeachment.
Okay, which
that's
one?
That's a real oldie.
Which one were you in that?
I was all of those people.
Oh.
Yes. I mean, the original thought was, it was the first time anyone had been impeached for about 100 years. Andrew Johnson was the previous one. There weren't a lot of people in America who remembered that. And everybody thought impeachment out. Like, when you were impeached, you were probably in jail or something. And so I wanted a way to just arrest, first of all, capture people's attention, and then hold it, and then teach them a lesson. And Mr. whatever his name is, Capo, learned the lesson in a muscular sort of way. I had an obsession at the time with a particular sportscaster who was
Yeah, you were Howard doing Cosell. Howard Cosell.
Yes. Yeah. I did Howard Cosell over and over. And Pacific Eye was Howard Cosell about a third of the time for no particular reason. And I don't even know whether a lot of people knew who it was. It was a vaguely Howard Cosell.
There would only have been a certain overlap between Pacifica listeners and Howard Cosell listeners.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Now, of course, we seem to have impeachments every few presidents.
Yes.
Do you think, and this is a serious question for you as a journalist, that the standards for that are being lowered, or are the presidents we're electing, Nixon, Clinton, Trump, just a bigger group of scoundrels?
I mean, that's a hard one to... for me, the issue is always when something new happens, when, you know, a telephone call that had always been 15 cents suddenly becomes a quarter and then more. And so suddenly inflation, a phrase you'd heard but you didn't know very well, or OPEC increases the price of oil. So when something new enters the ordinary life of people, whether it's just changes in banking and they give you a card to put into a machine instead of meeting Mrs. Jones, the teller you've had all your life, over my life, as each one of these sort of basically richly different changes take place in an ordinary life, I like to go and say, why is that happening? And then explain to people as best I can what the deeper meaning of this shift is. And it has remained for the whole 40-year run. It's just a wonderful way to wake up in the morning. Like, what is it that pricks me as different today, mm-hmm. and what's behind the change? That's really the...
And so this kind of thing has been your MO in pretty much all of your jobs, trying to explain a serious thing, but frequently using some kind of performance art, like we heard in that clip.
A lot of, it's a funny thing. In a biography I read of Abraham Lincoln, he was explaining to someone who asked him why he wasn't more scolding and more argumentative, why he told so many stories. Lincoln said to this fellow, he says, you know, I've found over my career that if I tell a short story in plain language, with humor added, it somehow lodges in the person's head and changes them in a softer and yet more lasting way. It's just my experience. So yes, I know how to hector, I know how to command a room in different ways, but this is the way that works softly and best, actually softly and hard. It makes a hard difference. And I've found the same thing. I've had lots of news directors at Pacifica in particular. There was a guy in Los Angeles who just hated that I would go to humor. And I could see, without actually seeing, the jugular vein in his neck as he cried out. He was Australian. He says, the news is not funny, Bob. It's not funny. And that has been a kind of a mantra that has followed me along. But I don't, the funny is actually serious for me. And
here's another example of Robert being creative. And Control Room, this is the one where he's on television in 1992. This is about a serious thing also. Bill Clinton has just been elected president. Uh-huh. You're on CBS This Morning with
Paul
Lazon.
Well, you really did research here. Yeah.
Oh, you gave me all these clips. And
Paul is on.
You're explaining a big problem with the economy that Clinton is inheriting after 12 years of Reagan and Bush. And you do it with the characters Wayne and Garth from Wayne's World.
Yeah.
This is a generation. Meet the 18 to 29-year-olds like Wayne and his friend Garth, who are, hello, convinced that it's their destiny to become poorer.
And it's Wayne and his friends speaking metaphorically, of course, that President Clinton will have to address today. Because when you talk about solving the long-term problems of America, they've got the problems that he is trying to solve.
It's not like this generation hasn't tried to do everything right. Like everybody, they look for work.
I've had plenty of Joe jobs. Nothing I'd call a career.
In fact, unemployment among 20 to 24-year-olds is 12%. That's almost twice the national average.
Let me put it this way. I have an extensive collection of name tags and hairnets.
And it's true. There are far fewer good jobs with good pay and a benefit package than there used to be. And then there's housing.
Okay, I still live with my parents, which I admit is both bogus and sad.
And not that unusual. 50% more 25 to 34-year-olds now live with their parents, which, by the way, saves money. Also, compared to their parents, Wayne's generation has children later and stays single longer.
Garth, marriage is punishment for shoplifting in some countries.
So they let you do that on CBS, explain unemployment with Wayne's World characters?
I have had a perpendicular relationship with most of the companies that I've worked for. Usually they hire you because in your previous existence, you've done something charming and idiosyncratic, and they say, oh, we need one, keyword, one of those. And then they invite you in, and as soon as you arrive, they say, no, not here. And then you have to kind of bat your head against the wall. And it's a little bit lonely sometimes, but it is very satisfying for some reason.
And it's been so much fun, I have to say, through this large sort of audio document dump and video document dump that you gave us and Andy Lancet, our archivist, help with, to go through and pick some out for the show and just see the amazing scope of your work and creativity in your work. On the content of that one, it's pretty amazing to look back on, because I think we always tend to think of the old days as the good old days, when really things we're concerned about today, in many cases, like, you know, we say the first generation with downward mobility and jobs that don't pay as well as the parents, it's that old. That was before Clinton joined NAFTA or the Modern World Trade Organization.
Yeah, it's really old. I think the first time I reported it out was on a CBS show with Leslie Stahl, and that was in 79. It was early. Yeah. And over time, you sometimes find that there were repeating themes in a career. So sometimes I remember once I put Paul Volcker in an opera, and I didn't ask Paul Volcker for his permission. I took a recitative opera by Mozart. So it was, you know, and then in the middle of it, there was Paul Volcker as a character. And I got a call from the Federal Reserve. And your hand begins to sweat rather thickly when these things happen. And you think, but first of all, there's this panic of, oh, why didn't I call and why didn't I tell him? But his wife wanted to give it as a party favor at his next birthday. So, you know, that was, but ask permission.
If it was Trump's Fed director, he would have said, your interest rates are going up, only yours.
Well, that's the other thing, is that there was a certain amount of forgiveness in the world. And the world is getting tighter, and the anger is higher, the brittleness, the how dare you is more often and more regular. And so it's taking, to be just joyous, you wouldn't think would be such an offensive thing, but it's harder, and you have to insist on it, I think.
So, Green Space audience, if you've always wanted to ask Robert Krulwich a question, but you never had him over to dinner, you can do it now. Raise your hand, and we'll come around with a mic. And listeners on the radio, wherever you are, same thing. Again, we don't have our usual phone number today. That's down. So if you want to call in, here's the number for right now, 212-675-6329. For anything you want to ask Robert Krulwich on the occasion of his retirement from Radiolab, 212-675-6329, 212-675-6329. Control room, we'll take a break before we play the other clips that we have from Robert. But before we go to the break and some of this other archive material, let's talk a little bit about how you got there. Where'd you grow up?
Here. In Manhattan.
Were
so did parents? My parents, and so did their parents. And my mom's from Tulsa, Oklahoma, but my father's from grandson is a sixth generation Manhattan born boy.
Wow.
In a row. I mean, even in Nantucket, that would be a thing, I think.
Did he buy Lower Manhattan for $24?
No. Although there is, I do have a relative who was named Krulwich. There was an E and a T in those days, and then one of the relatives named Krulwich got involved in some kind of moral situation, taking ladies across state lines for bad purposes, and my grandfather, in an effort to distinguish we Krulwiches from Krulwich, dropped the E and the T. I think in some part of his mind he thought, well, that would be like changing your name to Armstrong or something. I don't know. But he, so there's now Krulla Witches and there are Krull Witches, but they're all related to me, either group.
And when you were a kid, what did you fantasize about doing when you grew up? And I'm only talking about work. You can keep the other stuff to yourself. But what did you fantasize about doing when you grew up?
I did have, rather early on, a narrative sense. I would be in the tub, naked, with my feet up against the faucet, and there's a little bit of chrome around the faucet, and I would poke my face in so that I could see myself, and then I would, at the end of each day, do a show which had an open. I was about 7. It went around the nation, around the corner, around the nation, around the new world. This is the news that's making the news, and I'm Don Roberto. And I had a little, I had a fist that I would hold up as my microphone. And I continued to behave that way. I'd go to Madison Square Gardens to track meets and I'd have a pencil as a microphone.
You're still doing it, yeah.
Yeah, and but I never thought of it as a career or anything. It was just an enthusiasm.
You went to Oberlin. Why am I not surprised? What was your major at Oberlin?
History.
And I didn't know.
Jad went to Oberlin too, you understand.
I did not
know
that.
Yes, we're very OB-ish.
And I didn't know until I read it yesterday that you got a law degree from Columbia in 1974. Is that right?
That's right.
Why aren't you a lawyer?
Because the first lawyer that I worked with at a really fancy firm and a wonderful man whom I really loved turned to me in the summer where I was working. Actually, I was with now a U.S. senator. Chuck Schumer was in my group. He said to me, I'm going to offer you a job at this very fancy law firm, but you have to wait a year to accept it because I have this sense that this is not right for you, and I'm going to give you a gift, which is you will have a fancy, you can tell your parents that, you know, you're not going to be out in the rain, but there's something about you that just doesn't fit this profession. And it would be a great source of happiness to me if you would use this year to give me a call and tell me that you weren't going to come here, which was both a disaster to me. I was horrified because I admired him tremendously. And but it was a gift almost like no other gift a person gets to get. I was able then to go, instead of to a $22,000 a year job with, you know, working with very famous people, I could go to WBAI and have some guy in California say, "The news is not funny, Bob." And that was the alternatives, the road I took.
On line 3, Martha, is it East Windsor? Hi, Martha.
Hi, it's Marcia.
Marcia, yep. Hi, sorry.
Hi, I'm such a big fan of both of you, but just about Robert Krulwich, I am so devastated that you're retiring. It's very selfish, you deserve to retire, you're amazing, but I'm going to miss you so much.
Thank
I'm such a Radio Lab fan, and you provide so much balance to Jad's perspective, and I'm so upset. But anyway, I just wanted to ask, how do you think you develop this narrative storytelling? Almost, you bring like an air of spiritual or very human storytelling to things that are otherwise science and news driven. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, it makes perfect sense. It has to do to some degree with my brain, which I'm married to a very, very fast, smart woman. I mean, to the point where we would go to her house and her dad would say to me, because she has a very fast, smart brother, and he was a very fast, smart man, and he would say at the dinner table, "Do you mind, Robert, if we just talk a little faster?"
Really?
I'd say, "What? What do you mean?" He said, "You know, just a little faster." I said, "Oh, you don't think I could follow you guys when you talk fast?" And then it would be like Simish, you know. I couldn't understand anything that would happen, and they were all in full conversation. So I realized for a long time that I was a little bit of a slow processor, or maybe it was even like a level of learning disability in some cases. But I also realized that most people on most subjects are slow processors and know little to nothing about whether it be hockey or law or impeachment or foreign policy. So it wasn't such a terrible idea to go as slow as one of the slower people in the pack. And if you leavened it with humor and with a little bit of showbiz or just a little bit of humility, I think what Radiolab does very, very often is we just show you what it's like to be curious, that you stumble into problems, that you don't understand what the other guy heard, that you argue about what just happened, that those are important things to model, because to be curious is to be a little bit behind, which is a good thing. But it's not done very often in front of audiences. Most of journalism.
It's also
is,
to admit I don't know everything.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, in a tighter journalism situation, where you have a minute 50 or whatever, there you can't. Walter Cronkite never went on the air and said, "Tonight I really don't know how to pronounce this name," because really it wasn't that he was. It was just the clock would be ticking during that period, and then he wouldn't be able to finish his sentence if he confessed that he couldn't pronounce something.
So you pursued this as a business correspondent for NPR in the late 70s and early 80s. Here's a one-minute clip from September 29th, 1983, you talking to then All Things Considered host Susan Stamberg.
You know, Susan, advertisers are looking all the time for new places to put their ads.
I know. Somebody told me they put little ads now on the back of airplane boarding passes.
Really?
Yes.
In supermarkets, though, you see them on wagons and you see them on above the cashiers. Uh-huh. Well, now they've got a new idea.
What is it?
Software.
Software.
That's right. You know those floppy disks that contain everything you see on the screen, computer games, word processors, whatever? Well, that has now become a new advertising market with a very special advantage.
What is that?
Well, what makes software programs so attractive to advertisers is that the ads can be tailored to the very special circumstances of the user.
You mean a word processor could maybe...
That's right.
Hello, I am the Spellgood system. Sorry, you have just misspelled the word linguine, a common mistake. Perhaps you're getting hungry. Why not pick up the phone and call restaurant?
And then there are those games like Donkey Kong.
You have just killed a gorilla, but what about your own dog?
So that was like spell check in 1983.
Yeah, right. Wow. I don't remember that at all. We used to, the thing I most prize about that period was that Susan, there is in a creative life, there are sometimes you meet a person, Jad is certainly one, where all of a sudden you start to dance. And anything you want to do, you can do, because the other person kind of senses your next step. In Verdon Fossey, a television show recently, in that show, when Gwen Verdon meets Bob Fossey, they're very suspicious of each other, but they start to dance whatever Lola wants or whatever it is they're doing, and they're each one doing mischief on top of mischief, and they're getting giddy, and they're getting fluent. With Susan, with Jad, there's been a kind of a joy. And with Susan, we would like sometimes, we did a series called Business Shorts, but we would dance all the pieces, tap them. Of course, we weren't actually dancing, but I was tapping wildly and she was laughing and we were doing this, you know, hey, Mrs. Jones, that kind of vaudeville's voice. And it was like, it was like enchanting.
So here's a 2-minute Radiolab excerpt. I don't think it needs setting up. It's Robert and Jad, but it starts with Johnny Cash.
I've got 25 minutes to go.
Is that Johnny Cash?
Yes, it's Johnny Cash, and he's singing a song about the deep importance of mathematics in your life.
I got 24 minutes to go.
There's no math here. What are you talking about?
You know, there's a lot of math here, because you see, what he's doing is he's moving to his extinction, it seems, but he's being very careful to calibrate.
I got 22 minutes to go.
Oh my God, we're going to go all the way to one? I feel like I've been listening to this song for 3 hours already. The numbers are making it tedious. If I were him, I'd lose the numbers.
You'd lose the numbers?
Yes.
You can't lose the numbers. You cannot lose the numbers, because numbers create order in your life.
I could lose the numbers. I could survive an entire, my whole life without them.
That's just completely ridiculous.
Easily.
No.
Try me.
All right, let me just ask you something very simple.
Yeah.
You go to buy some M&Ms, and you have a $5 bill in your hand, and you give it to the vendor, and the vendor gives you back the M&Ms, and what?
No numbers required. I hand him the bill, he hands me some change, I just go by trust.
You go by trust.
Yeah.
He asked you how old you are. What do you say?
I'm middle-aged, I tell him.
With 11 more minutes to go.
Listen to that. You hear that? Suppose that you're late for an appointment or something like that. You call up and you say, I'm going to be 3 minutes late, 5 minutes late, 10 minutes late.
I usually just wait for the call before I leave.
I know that.
Which you know is true.
I know it's true.
So, yeah, don't need them. Don't need them.
You're a test. You're taking a test in school. You get a 98. You get a 52. You don't care?
Pass, fail.
How much gas is in your car, Jen?
I wait for the light to come on.
Suppose you want to call me. Right? Yeah, and you can't remember my phone number.
Two words. What? Speed dial.
How many words?
You see, you gotta use numbers. So what was all that about? I'm sure Dad doesn't really hate numbers.
No, we had a show about numbers, and we realized that most people would immediately turn off a show about numbers, so one of us decided to be an anti-numeral person. He fell into the role rather quickly, and we love fighting, so I just decided to throw everything at him, and then he... I don't really think that was scripted or anything.
Wow.
I mean, we realized early on that Ira Glass had the kind of preeminent program, and his was written, and you could hear people reading. So we went through the rather stupid approach of doing everything live and then basically editing it back into shape. So everything is improvised, but the edit is actually a manufacture. But therefore, everything you hear is just literally bleh, right off the top of your...
Amazing. It must be so much fun to be in the room.
It's a lot of fun.
So we only have 2 minutes left, but I think somebody here had your hand up here in the green space. Who was that? You have it right there? Yeah. Hi.
Hi, Robert. Thank you very much for your excellent body of work. I wanted to ask about Oliver Sacks, although we're running out of time. I know he was prominent on Radiolab.
Mm-hmm. He's prominent in my heart. Oliver Sacks was just peculiarly about what I love to think about. He also took a field that was difficult, neuroscience, and somehow came up by doing these individual case studies with such extreme emotional and gorgeous detail. He turned something complicated into a story that in the Lincoln form would just stay in your head and open you up to a whole new set of ideas. So there are some people who just work the foyer as opposed to the living room. They bring all kinds of people in, and they get used to and comfortable with a subject. And Oliver did that in a way that is just rare.
Work the foyer instead of the living room. What a way to put it. So you're retiring from full-time work at Radiolab, but you were telling me off the air you have some projects in the works. Anything you want to say publicly?
One of them has to do with Oliver Sacks. It's a conversation that I started with Oliver Sacks. It's a film. I don't know. I'm doing things that I never thought I could do, like internet interactive stuff. I mean, just the next set of things. I mean, podcasts are now so huge, and we were there very, very early. So I thought, well, what's the next thing? And it occurred to me that maybe just, you know, drawing and typing and going back. But I don't know how to code. I do know how to draw. But I don't have the faintest idea of how to make it come alive. So once again, I'm working with the news is not funny, mom, people. Who in this case says, no, it's a straight line. They're not all British. I don't know why I did. But I'm throwing myself in with a bunch of very, very talented, very different sets of people, but very talented in new ways to me. And I'm comfortably terrified.
So watch this space. Robert Krulwich will be back in one way or another. Please thank Robert Krulwich for his body of work. And listeners, thank you so much. And audience, thank you so much for coming to the Green Space. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and if you followed the reporting of WNYC and Gothamist's Christopher Wirth over the past year, you've been following the story of lead. How that old toxic paint additive persists in city schools and in homes and is still making thousands of kids sick or even permanently addled. Most recently, WNYC found that the Department of Education consistently failed to follow requirements for annual lead paint inspections in city schools, finding that only 12% of schools serving young children were inspected once a year between 2015 and 2019. When I posed that question to the mayor last Friday, he said he was aware of the problem and the city was on the right track.
Everything I have seen, everything I know suggests that there's a lot more testing that was done then has been documented. But the fact that it has not been properly documented is unacceptable. We did a whole diagnostic of what happened. We found a lot of things that needed to be fixed. They have been addressed, and now all the relevant classrooms have been properly inspected, has been properly documented.
So some dispute on the amount of testing, but overall the mayor says they're working on it. In that answer, the mayor also said lead in schools was not the biggest problem making kids sick.
The schools have not been the challenge historically. The challenge has been housing, and ironically, well, although so much attention was on NYCHA, the real challenge is private housing. That is where we have the real core of lead problems that must be addressed.
And so there he is. The schools, not that much of a problem. Homes are the problem. Though there are laws on the books to hold landlords accountable to take lead out of homes, the city rarely enforces them, though in the past few months, city council is trying to change that. Here with me to talk about his latest reporting on lead in schools and what the city is doing to get lead out of homes is Christopher Wirth, senior editor at the WNYC Narrative Unit. Also, Matthew Shasher, staff lawyer at the North Manhattan Improvement Corporation, and Cordell Clear, an activist in the fight against lead poisoning. So, hi, Christopher, and welcome, Matthew and Cordell.
Hey, Brian.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So, Chris, first, if I have my numbers correct, 3,866 children tested positive for lead levels in their blood last year. Is there any way to know where these kids are coming into contact with lead? Partly because I don't want to alarm people regarding situations they shouldn't be alarmed about, which is what the mayor seems to be saying about the schools compared to private homes.
Yeah, so if you look at Department of Health data on those 3,800 kids who tested with elevated blood lead levels in 2018, the vast majority of them, as the Department of Health is able to document, were tested positive or were exposed to lead in private housing. NYCHA, you know, we tend to focus a lot on NYCHA on this story, but really NYCHA kids in NYCHA only make up about 3% of that total. 97% of those kids are in private housing. But on the school's issue, in looking at where kids are poisoned and how many kids are poisoned and how many kids are actually tested in New York City, we don't really have a lot of data, testing data for kids of older ages, school-age children, to know whether or not children are actually being exposed in schools or not.
And to go behind the scenes of this reporting, the city, as I understand it, only did a round of school inspections last summer because of your reporting, and they maintained that inspections had been happening all along. You determined now that that was false.
That's right. We were able to get our hands on the data. When our story first ran last summer, we could see in the data that DOE immediately started to inspect those classrooms. Our story ran on June 24th. By June 25th, they were already in those classrooms documenting visual inspections of those classrooms. We continued to ask the mayor and we continued to ask DOE officials whether or not those inspections had been taking place annually as they'd been required. The Department of Health, the health code, requires annual inspections of classrooms for children under six. What we found when we actually got our hands on the data was, as you said, 12% of the classrooms had actually been inspected on an annual basis going back to 2015.
And what do you think of the mayor's response from the show on Friday last week, where he said there was more testing that had been documented now and all the relevant classrooms have been inspected?
It looks like all the relevant classrooms have been inspected. There are, you know, continue to be questions whether or not the DOE should expand its inspection protocols to look at second grade, third grade, fourth grade, upper grades. There's no reason really that, as I'm told, that those children that are who are 7 or 8 or 9 should not also enjoy the same protections in their classrooms as 6-year-olds.
All right, let's turn to homes, because that is such a big piece of this, the biggest, by all accounts, and Cordell Clear, who is an activist in the fight against lead poisoning in New York City. I know this is personal to you and to your family. Do you want to give us some background on yourself a little bit and then talk about the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so they're one and the same. I got into this because I have a child that was affected by lead poisoning. Something that I knew nothing about and, in fact, quite frankly, thought didn't even exist anymore. And this was in 1994. And, you know, I just couldn't imagine that this was a problem, especially since I had reported violations in my apartment, peeling paint, crumbling ceilings, and various other violations. And the appropriate agencies came out, and never once did anybody mention to me the possibility of lead. I was just concerned about the dangers and the fall, the place falling apart. Unfortunately, I found out about lead through my child being affected. And I knew that had to be wrong, that he should not have been the canary in the gold, in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be doing it like that. And that was when I started in the movement. And I know that I'm pretty, you know, knowledgeable. I read, I try to be in the know. And I knew that if I didn't know about this, many other parents didn't know about it. And that was what prompted me to start fighting to make sure that our children are protected.
And so you helped launch that fight in the 90s. Then in 2004, Local Law 1 was passed. And Matthew, you were instrumental in designing that law, I understand. What was in it and how did you come to it?
I started working in this issue in the early 90s. And Cordell Clear actually was a client of mine. And one of the things we built into the current law was a requirement that when the city goes and does an inspection, they have to do an inquiry as to whether there's a child of under the age of six, and if so, inspect for lead. That we call the Cordell Clear provision in the current law. That resulted in a 600% increase in code enforcement in the first year of the law. But in the big picture of the law, it was very much a compromise. The idea was the prior law said that you had to take all the lead paint out. There was huge pushback that was not practical. So the idea of the current law was to place a large part of the onus on owners to keep their property safe, because at any given time, there were about 300,000 units of older housing stock in New York City with kids under the age of six that are presumably have lead paint hazards. Now, we don't have 300,000 poison kids a year, so obviously the focus has to be on the bad landlords. Mm-hmm. But the city does not have the resources to inspect 300,000 units of housing a year. No way can it do it. So the law required several proactive measures by landlords. If they're not going to take all the lead paint out, they have to at least permanently abate the lead on the highest risk surfaces when there's a change of tenancy. They're called the friction surfaces on doors and windows, because those create lead dust even if they're intact. And number two, that owners, if they're not going to take all the lead paint out, must inspect their own apartments at least once a year, more often as needed, for lead hazards. Correct them safely and document this in writing. Those two provisions of the law, until December of last year, the city did exactly zero enforcement of. They wrote two violations for each of those conditions in the 16 years, and those since that law was passed, and those were cases that I brought the city and the landlord to court. The city council did some amendments to the law last year, and one of the things that was put in was the city has to do audits of 200 buildings a year to see how landlords are doing with this. They need to start enforcing this law. And I just want to give you an interesting statistic, because I was looking just last night, and I don't know how many of the buildings they've done thus far, but thus altogether, at least the data shows that there are 132 buildings where the city found noncompliance with the turnover. I don't know if they've reached their 200 inspections yet, but that indicates at least about 65% noncompliance. And with the annual inspections, it's the same thing. It's 126 buildings thus far. They found the landlords were not doing the annual inspections. This is a huge problem. I think the mayor is completely right. The problem is private housing. I'm glad to see the city is finally starting to take, 16 years later, responsibility to enforce this law. But it points to a very, very large problem.
Listeners, we can take some phone calls if you have a question, maybe about a potential lead problem in your own apartment or anything else, maybe a story. For our guests, WNYC's Christopher Wirth, who's been covering lead in schools and other lead problems in New York City, and Matthew Shasher, who was just speaking, staff lawyer at the North Manhattan Improvement Corporation, and Cordell Clear, a longtime activist in the fight against lead poisoning, and as you heard in that 2004 law, because of what happened in her family, there was the, Matthew, you called it the Cordell Clear provision.
That's right.
And our phone number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Also joining us for a few minutes is Sakia Colon. She lives in the Bronx with her son, who experienced lead poisoning. Matthew is representing her. Sakia, thanks so much for coming on with us. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Tell us your story a little bit, if you don't mind. How did you find that your son was sick from lead?
Well, I took him for a regular checkup. I decided to switch hospitals. So I took him to a new hospital, so they had to do a routine checkup and do blood work. And when they did blood work, we found out that he had lead levels of 14. From what I was told, once your lead level is like at 5, the hospital is obligated to send your results into the state. And the state contacted me. They had someone come into my house, someone from like Healthy Homes. That person, she checked with a machine for lead. There was lead found in two places in my home. That same night, the super of my building went into my apartment like around 8 o'clock at night and starting removing the lead while me and my son were inside the house. He started sweeping the lead from my room to the kitchen.
In other words, in the act of getting rid of it, he did it badly and gave you even more exposure?
Correct. Then me and my son had to leave our house. There's like apartments that they have like to place you when you're taken out of your home for this. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any available because there was no heating or something in one of the floors. So they had like a whole floor closed off. So we weren't able to get a room there. My son gets busing to school. So I had to, wherever I spend the night, I had to like take a cab or something just to let him get to school. Then about 3 weeks or so later, we were allowed to come back in the house. At this point, the state was sent back into, let me move back a little bit. Then they actually sent an actual team that they're just for that, just to remove the lead the proper way. Like, you know, putting down plastic, making sure that it doesn't get further exposed, but that they remove it properly, take all their garbage, take everything with them. So someone came in, actually did that. Then they sent someone from the state to check that work. The way that the representative checked to see if there was lead, she sat down in my couch and she looked around and she said that it looked like work was done. So that's it, that the problem was resolved. From my understanding, the only way for you to know that there's lead on anything is either by that machine that they used to check or by dust wipes. Mm-hmm. She didn't do either or. She just sat there and she said that it looked like, because they did change like my door. So I guess since they changed my door, that was her way of seeing that they changed the lead.
And Sakia, what's the end of the story with all that you went through, and even people, as you're describing it, who supposedly were there to help, from the super to the representative from the state, were either not helping much or even making it worse. Are you back in the same apartment now, and how is your son?
I'm still in the same apartment. My son still has lead. It had gone down, but now it went right back up. Ever since my son was they found the lead in his system. I've been going to the hospital every 3 months to get him checked up for it. It's still there. It hasn't left. My son has developed asthma, which I do not know if it has, you know, any connection to do with this. There was still actually lead present in my house. And I found this out from dust wipes that I had done at my apartment. Mm. And I let this know to the state. And till this day, they still haven't come back to do anything about that.
And so, Matthew, you're representing Sakia, I understand. And before she goes, is there anything that you want to say, maybe, you know, about the legal aspect of this or about how this is representative of a larger problem?
Yeah, well, one of the things that happened in Ms. Colon's apartment is that there was lead-based paint on the doors and the window frames. This should have been permanently abated before she moved in. She moved in after that law went into effect. And this is a perfect example.
So when the apartments turn over, that's what the law was kind of most directly aimed at, right?
Yeah, and you know, the original draft of what became Local Law 1 actually had a provision that we were going to sunset lead paint on friction surfaces through all of New York. In other words, by I think 2007, it would be mandated that the lead be abated on friction surfaces in all child-occupied dwellings. There was huge pushback from the Bloomberg administration saying, no, we can't do that, but trust us, we'll make sure landlords do it at vacancy. That turned out to not be the case, and that's why I would say Ms. Colon's child became lead poisoned. So there are consequences to non-enforcement.
Sakia, good luck to you. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
So
I'm sure it's painful for you, but it's helpful to others to hear it.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And let's take a phone call. This is from out of the city, but, you know, in our area and very relevant. Chantel in Rockland County. You're on WNYC. Hi, Chantel.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
So I'm calling in. Thank you for taking my phone call. I'm calling in because I live in a low-income apartment, and it is disgusting the way that we have to live. But one of my concern is hearing the gentleman speak and hearing all these steps that was taken about the lead. I have almost a four-year-old daughter, and what I've seen is that there are paints chipping around the apartment, especially in the kitchen area. And I was wondering, because from what they said, that's the signs, couple of the signs, and there's some black stuff coming out of the wall. So I was wondering, how do you get the lead? How do you test for lead or to know that there is lead going on in your apartment to prevent certain things from happening?
Matthew, can you help her?
I can and I can't. I can answer the second question, which is the only way really to detect lead is to use a device called an XRF, which stands for an X-ray fluoroscope, which is a very expensive device that local governments will buy, like New York City, that shoots a beam of X-rays and detects the lead. The problem is how do you get access to an inspection of your apartment? And while I'll be the first to complain that the laws in New York City are not fully enforced, at least we have prevention laws. Unfortunately, although New York State has the highest number and percentage of older housing stock in the nation and the highest number of lead poisoned children in the nation, basically outside of New York City and Rochester, there are no prevention laws for lead poisoning. In essence, the state still is using what Cordell called the miner's canary mode of checking for lead by finding out if the kids are poisoned. I would strongly suggest at least contacting the county health department in Rockland and seeing if they can provide some services. They generally respond, alas, unfortunately, only when kids are lead poisoned. But they may have some programs to assist. The state is funding some programs in high-risk areas of the state to do some proactive prevention work on lead hazards.
Thank you.
Chantel, thank you so much. Good luck with that. That's at least somewhere where she can go. And that's kind of a shocking thing that you revealed there, though, Matthew, that other than New York City and Rochester, that the laws, even now, with all we know and with all the kids who have been lead poisoned, the laws are so weak.
Yeah.
Michael in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to call and say that Ms. Clear is not saying how heroic she was, because she got a job with city council member Bill Perkins and got Perkins to sponsor this bill in the city of New York.
Yes.
And when it happened, the thing I remember most is Mr. Bloomberg, who's so much in the news now, his saying that if this law passed, it would bankrupt the real estate industry of New York. And, of course, that didn't happen, but it just goes to show how duplicitous he is and how we still are having this problem to this very day.
Michael, thank you. And so, Cordell Clear, let me go back to you. And he's right that you got involved with city councilman at the time, Bill Perkins, after your son had the lead problem from your apartment. And how does your understanding of the history and the Bloomberg administration's role comport with the callers?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that Michael brings that up because it's on my mind a lot lately. Never thought this person would run for president, but when I remember him vetoing the bill after Matt and so many others had come together, we had all worked so hard, 12 years of my life, and many, many people before me for decades have been fighting for this protection for our children, and we got a city council who did the right thing. And to have the mayor knock it down, veto it. Thank God we kept at it. We didn't give up. We worked hard, and we had good people, and the city council overrode it. But, you know, for it just goes to show, you know, for an individual to have to go through all of that, when we have agencies and leaders that are supposed to be protecting our children, and somebody has to go through all of that just to get a lead poisoning bill passed, and then now a kick in the face is that we're not even enforcing it.
And so is this something, Matthew, that you think Michael Bloomberg should be held accountable for on the campaign trail? Because I think you were indicating before that when local law was passed in 2004, that was in his administration, he signed it, but that he worked to weaken it so that it was only upon the vacancy of an apartment that there needed to be an inspection and remediation for lead as opposed to checking out every apartment?
Well, first of all, he didn't sign it. Oh. It was vetoed.
Oh,
And his veto was overridden by the city council.
I don't know this history.
Yes.
Tell us more.
And then the real estate industry brought a lawsuit to block it from going into effect. Mayor Bloomberg refused to allow the city's own lawyers to represent the city in that lawsuit to defend the law. So instead, the city council had to hire outside lawyers, and we, the advocates, also went into that case to defend the law successfully. So yeah, his role was not good. He fought against this law very strongly. I think it's much stronger. And in fact, the advocates negotiated a lot away under the promise that he wouldn't veto the bill, and then he ended up vetoing it anyway.
Huh. And yeah. As we finish up, WNYC's Christopher Wirth, I read this week that there's a federal probe underway to investigate landlords who take Section 8 vouchers, that this particular group of landlords can be particularly negligent when following lead laws. And you talked to a doctor who said, we're measuring lead in the wrong units. So what did he mean by that? And anything else you'd like to say to wrap this up?
Well, we're measuring lead in the... Well, I think it goes back to what Matthew had said, which is that we do continue to use kids very much as indicators. So when a child tests with an elevated blood lead level, that test is then reported to the Department of Health, and then the Department of Health will start an investigation to find out if there's lead in the apartment. And if they don't find lead in the apartment, that investigation expands to other places.
So first a human child has to be sick.
So in many cases, what has to happen first is a child has to have an elevated blood lead level, whereas the law was originally designed to prevent exposure in the first place. And I think Matthew can speak to that as well.
Yes, but very briefly, the federal investigation is actually about a much larger issue that I've been trying to get the city to pay attention to, which is the fact that the city has a negligent practice of placing families out of homeless shelters or with other city subsidies into private rental homes without verifying that the landlord has complied first with Local Law 1, whether the landlord abated the lead on the friction surfaces. And we have had case after case after case of families who are relying on the city to put them in these homes and assuming that they're safe and finding out the hard way that it's not safe and their kids get lead poisoned.
We thank Matthew Shashera, staff lawyer at North Manhattan Improvement Corporation, Cordell Clear, activist in the fight against lead poisoning, and WNYC's Christopher Wirth, senior editor in our narrative unit. Cordell, thanks so much. I know you're on the phone with us. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Matthew, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Brian.
Chris, thank you as always.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now to your calls. If you've ever been asked by a total stranger to pretend to know you when that person felt in danger, or if you were the person asking, maybe these stories will help other people to protect themselves in, you know, potentially dangerous situations. You don't really know in a situation like this, but you think it's possible, and that's why you would do it. So 212-433-WNYC, and Crystal in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Crystal.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for calling. What happened to you?
I was at a conference at a hotel, and in the evening, I wanted to use the free Wi-Fi, so I went down to the bar and was just ticking through some emails, and there was, it seemed like a couple next to me, but as I sat for longer, I realized they were not a couple, and the guy was being really annoying and just kept in every way, shape, or fashion asking to go upstairs and just being really coercive. And it started feeling yucky to me. I just like looked up from my computer and was like, oh my God, Sheila, I didn't know you were at this conference too. This is crazy. We have to go get a bite now. This is just, I can't believe I'm seeing you here.
That's such a great story, and I'll let you finish it. But even what you've just told puts a whole other angle on it than even what I set up, because you saw a situation in progress. You weren't even asked to intervene, and you pretended to be this person's friend, right?
Yeah. And she, like, looked me straight in the eye and, like, swiveled her bar stool around and just mouthed the word thank you and was like, yes, let's get a table. And said goodbye to the gentleman at the bar, and we both sat and had a really nice little chat and a meal.
So are you and Sheila friends to this day?
We are Instagram friends.
It's a great story, Crystal. Thank you so much. May somebody do that for someone else after hearing that story. Michelle in Los Angeles, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So my story, I guess, on the opposite end. This was a few years ago in Chicago. I was at the bank using the ATM, but since it was a Sunday, I was just in the vestibule that you need an actual bank card to open. And there was a man who was just, like, staring at me through the glass in a way that made me feel really unsafe, even though it was noon on a Sunday. So I could just tell he was waiting for me to leave. So I had to wait inside probably about 10 minutes until finally a man came in who, because of his size or his demeanor and just out of desperation, I took a chance and I said, listen, this is really weird, but I need you to pretend to know me and escort me out of here, and I need to get a ride in your car. So after I ended up getting a ride in the second stranger's car, and after getting to, like, I got back to my neighborhood, this was after the first man who was waiting for me, who I was avoiding, ended up running after us to the car and trying to open the door and get inside.
Wow.
So I was really, really thankful that this man was there, and I just kind of really had to calculate in the moment. I was like, I know I'm getting into a car with another strange man, but I had to make a decision.
Yeah, I guess you made the right decision. I guess the odds are in your favor there, because most people who you pick out randomly on the street are not going to attack you. Somebody might.
You have to believe that.
But at least the odds are in your favor that time. So is there a kind of a lesson in this for other people in any way?
Well, I guess what you said, just I understand that strangers are mostly nice people, and I've never had a problem talking to strangers or approaching people. In fact, sometimes I'm too gullible in that way. But yeah, and also just being alert, like it was just, you know, a Sunday morning.
Yeah. Michelle, thank you so much for sharing your story. Glenn in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Brian. Yeah, what happened to me one time, this was back in 1988, I was on a subway platform at Union Square, and a guy comes up to me And he says, hey, how you doing? Good to see you. I know you don't know me, but there's these kids over there that are kind of looking at me, following me around. And if we can just talk for a few minutes, I think maybe it'll be okay. And it was.
And it was. And that's the end of the story.
That's it.
Thank you very much. Mary Ann on the Upper West Side. You're on WNYC. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi. My story is that in the 1970s, about 77, I was walking from work on Columbus Avenue, and this was before it was gentrified. It was a shell, and I was between 68th and 69th Street, and a car screeched to a halt. This was about 9 or 9:30 at night. Car screeched to a halt. Four men in it, two of them on the passenger side, opened their doors at the same time, raced out to grab me. I saw three men at about half a block away from me, closer to 68th Street, and I just started calling common names. Bill, Harry, Joey, wait for me, wait for me, hey, hey. Mm. And the three men turned to see what the ruckus was. The two men who almost had me by the arm let go. They just pulled back, and they jumped back in the car and drove away. The three men started toward me and said, are you all right? I said, and I ran to them. I ran to them, and I got into the middle of them, and I said, you just saw it. They said, yes, we just saw it. And they walked me to my home.
And you bailed yourself out in that situation. You didn't even ask the guys for help while it was before it was going on, or before it could have gotten to that point. You're saying they were actually, these bad guys were actually trying to grab you. And you thought of shouting out to these other bypassers. So you pulled yourself out of that jam.
Yeah, but if they hadn't turned around, if they had just ignored me, who knows?
Marianne, thank you for sharing your story. Stephen in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stephen. Is that Stephen in Brooklyn? Hi.
Yeah, my story sort of flips it on its head a little bit. It was like 10 years ago at a punk rock show. A good friend of mine, still a good friend of mine, who started dating this girl. And, you know, we barely knew each other. I mean, and she was getting hassled at a show by a couple of dudes. Her boyfriend wasn't there. And I sort of just walked up and nonchalantly just grabbed her by the arm and, like, took over the conversation nonchalantly. And, you know, she if she was uncomfortable then, it was when she turned and realized that she recognized me, and I, you know, basically escorted her away from them.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, it was what it was. And she's perfectly fine. We're friends to this day. You know, Trevor and her are married, and we're still friends. And, you know, she sort of remembers that, and kind of curious about your take on that.
Stephen, I appreciate your story, and I'm going to just leave it there as a story, and I'm going to move on to other people's stories. So thank you very much. Here's one from Twitter. A listener writes, in France, a man followed me from the train into the station. I knew he wasn't going to leave, so I sought out an English-speaking woman I found in the bathroom. How did we get from a train station to knowing that there was an English-speaking woman in the bathroom? I'm not sure. But asked her to pretend we were friends until he left. She was there with her husband, and they took me to dinner. So that's a nice story that ends with going out to dinner with the new friends. Deborah in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So about 17 years ago, I used to periodically sleep over at my grandmother's house. She lived out in Midwood, Brooklyn, which is sort of a suburban type part of the city. And I would get up really early so I could go to the gym before work. So I was walking from her house to the Avenue M train station, which at the time was the D and the Q. I don't think it is the Q anymore, but I was about three blocks away from the subway, and a young man was walking towards me. There weren't too many people on the street. I didn't think much of it. I'd been spending a lot of time in the city. People always come and go.
But what this young man did was he whacked me in the chest, right on my breast. And I think he expected me to drop my belongings. I had a briefcase and a gym bag and my pocketbook. But I was wearing my sneakers, and I was pretty much a runner. So instead, I screamed really loud, and I just took off. And I sprinted to the subway. I had my token in hand, which I always used to do. So this was a long time ago.
I guess so.
And I got through the train station. I remember feeling this huge sigh of relief. I'm safe. I'm fine. I was walking up to the platform, and I was actually going farther into Brooklyn. But then I saw he was on the other side. He must have thought I was going
the same guy. He followed you.
He followed me. And he must have thought I was heading into Manhattan because he was on the Manhattan side. But as soon as he saw me on the Brooklyn side, it was like out of a movie. I saw that recognition, and he was going down the stairs, and he was going to come up the other side. And I was really panicking, and I didn't know what to do. There was nobody around, and it was almost like a Hollywood movie. All of a sudden, I looked up, and there was this burly African-American man, very tall and big. I think he was a transit worker, and I just ran up to him and said, "Can you please help me? I think this man is trying to hurt me. Mm-hmm. I'm really scared." And he said, "No problem. Just stick with me." And I stood by his side, and this younger man did see us. I guess it intimidated him. The train arrived just around that time. I got on the train. I don't know what happened to the younger fellow, but the man who helped me, we went a few stations together. And it was just a huge sigh of relief. And I remember thinking, wow, there are so many nice New Yorkers out there.
Mm-hmm. It's a great, you know, and great story, Deborah. And the guy actually got on the train with you, transit worker or whoever he was, mm-hmm. got on mm-hmm. the train and rode a few stops with you.
He did. I was really, really nervous.
And it sounds like he had the presence of mind, from the way you tell it, to even take a reassuring demeanor and respond to you initially by saying, "Don't worry, stick with me."
Exactly, exactly. He really did reassure me. To this day, I will never forget him. He's out there somewhere. He's Joe. His name is Joe.
Deborah, thanks for your story. And Joe, thanks for bailing Deborah out. Thank you for your call. Maggie in Seacliff, you're on WNYC. Hi, Maggie.
Hey, how are you? So I was coming back from a theater show late in the evening. I was walking on 8th Avenue, an avenue which I pretty much never take. I was trying to get to Penn Station. And at some point, this guy was following me, and I dipped into a store. I pretended I was on my phone, and he just kept on me for about two blocks. And then I walked another three more blocks, and I started to get nervous. I thought, oh my God, he's going to follow me all the way into Penn Station. So I saw this couple up ahead, and I just latched myself onto them. I just grabbed the woman by her arm, and I said, "Please pretend you know me and walk with me, because this man is following me." And they actually walked me all the way to Penn Station. And when I got there, I just, you know, ran into my train, and that was that.
What was the reaction of the person when you said, "Pretend to know me"?
I think at first they were like, "Oh my God, like, you're touching me, you're holding on to me." But after they saw my face, I guess, my face, my voice, they said no problem. And they started talking to me, you know, just talking about what we were doing that night. And they asked me if, you know, where is the guy, you know, the other guy tried to, the guy that was with the woman tried to turn around to see if he was still following us. And they were actually very, very nice, very kind.
Have you shared this story with other people over time? And it's, you know, it's instructive that this this segment is drawing. I mean, we could go on and on and on. I have, you know, a full board of calls, and every time somebody finishes a story, somebody else is there, boom, with one to share. And I think the usefulness of this whole thing has been that people know you can do this. There are people out, this is one way to get out of a, you know, potentially dangerous situation. Did you tell a lot of people after this? And we have about 10 seconds left.
I actually didn't, but your callers actually inspired me. When I was in college, just very quickly, a girl was being followed by a gang of boys, and my friend and I just went up to her and like, "Hey, how are you, Carrie?" And we didn't know her name. We just took her by the arm and lent our way. So yeah, I guess it's something instinctual.
Maggie, thank you so much. Glad you're okay. And yeah, the three prongs, right? You can ask somebody for help, you can be helped, or if you see something in progress that looks sketchy to you, you can just insert yourself and say, Maggie, I haven't seen you in so long. Anyway, thank you all for your stories. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.